start with some wintry showers, even at lower levels across Scotland, but on the hills further south too, a very squally day. And the winds are being warned off for Saturday because they combine with some very high astronomical tides and we could see some coastal flooding. So lots to watch. The warnings, as ever, Neil, are on the website.
All right. Many thanks, Helen Willards. Jermaine Greer has bought a piece of rainforest in her native Australia, but as a rainforest virgin, she's discovered that she has much to learn. For instance, the hero of her story, which gives her book its title, White Beech, turns out to be neither white nor a beech.
The settlers who turned up in southern Queensland in the second half of the 19th century were confronted by a vast array of tree species that weren't related, even distantly, to the trees they'd grown up with. They knew the huge red cedar by reputation, but no book has ever celebrated the even more charismatic species known as white beech. It was the first of the subtropical rainforest tree species to be logged out. The name white beech could refer to any one of half a dozen subtropical tree species. The one this book is named after is Gmelina leichhardtii. This is a stupendous tree, growing to 40 metres in height, with a straight trunk, just asking to be cut down, slabbed up and shipped off, which is what had already happened to most white beeches by the beginning of the 20th century. Forests aren't just bunches of trees. Supposing you plant a few hundred trees on an acre of ground, for a few years they'll grow on side by side like a plantation, until gradually the faster growing trees will shade the others out. Some of the outstripped trees will die, others will accept life in the understory, and still more will wait for a neighbouring tree to fall. Meanwhile, the trees that are pushing towards the sky will sacrifice their lateral branches as the canopy lifts further and further off the ground. Trees that top out above the others will spread their canopies, snaring more and more of the light. On the forest floor, a galaxy of shade-loving organisms will begin to appear. Mosses, fungi, ground covers, ferns. With them will come hundreds of invertebrate species. Eventually, the forest achieves equilibrium. But this is not static. There's more to a tree than meets the eye. The forest tree is a powerhouse, converting light, gas, and moisture to nutrients not only for itself, but for a whole population that lives on and by it. Some of these dependents are spectacular, like the epiphytic ferns and orchids and the mistletoes. Others are subtle, like the mites that live in the water-filled cavities in the bark. The tree isn't only important in itself, it's also important as a contributor to the canopy, which governs the microclimate that makes possible the massive biodiversity of the forest. It's now thought that one way Australia's tree frogs escape chytrid fungus disease is by taking to the canopy. If there's no canopy, there's no escape. All kinds of organisms, from seaweeds and corals and mosses, to the loftiest trees tend to form canopies if they can. Canopy science is only 15 years old, but we're beginning to understand that canopies are an optimum form of vegetation. Most Australians have never heard of white beech, but for 30 years or so when it was enthusiastically promoted as an export timber, it was internationally famous. Because it was durable, easily worked and non-shrinking, the first dwellings, barns, schools and churches in the Nhumbindah Valley were built of white beech. But despite its high value, much of the white beech that was felled was left to rot, sometimes because there was no way of getting the bullock teams within reach of the fallen timber, but as often because the timber getters couldn't afford the cost of transporting it. White beeches can't grow as fast as the pioneer species that shot up wherever the timber getters tore down the ancient canopy. They couldn't have replaced themselves quickly, even if they'd been given a chance, and they weren't. In 1916, when the English Chief Forest Officer visited Queensland, he was scandalised to find that there'd been no survey of the forest. The Queenslander added that three valuable Queensland timbers are nearly extinct, cedar, silky oak, and white beech. Cave Creek is one of the very few places where white beech survived. What typifies the specialness of Cave Creek as a Gondwanan refugium for me is white beech. Here's the how and why. I hadn't been responsible for the forest long when I paused on my pre-breakfast walk to watch golden whistlers popping in and out of an immense pyramid of lantana on the creek edge. As the whistlers skimmed about me, I turned my binoculars upward. Such a vast pyramid of lantana had to be sprawling over a seriously big tree. But what? Most of the leaves that I could pick out among the canes were lantana, pale-stemmed, bright green, chordate. Others, a very few, were different. Bigger, denser, with a stout network of leaf veins visible against the light. I poked around on the ground and found a thick yellowing leaf, still greenish on one side, buff gold and slightly felted on the other. I tested it against the faraway shape I could see outlined against the sky. It matched. I hunted about for more but found none. I put the single leaf in my trouser pocket and took it back to the house. An hour later, when the white flare of the sun had spilled over the scarp and the air was full of sizzling radiance, I betook me to the shade of the veranda for a homemade caffè latte and a bit of botanizing with the field guide we call the Red Book by Gwen Harden, Bill McDonald and John Williams. My sister Jane, who was on holidays and hence not expected to go marching off at the first light of dawn, was having a late breakfast. Now, Jane's a proper botanist and my willing but demanding preceptor in matters botanical. "So?" she asked, mopping up the last of her stewed tomatoes with her last bit of toast. It's a leaf," I said. "Was that all you could get? The tree's enormous, 100 feet high or so, but it's completely covered by lantana. I couldn't even see the branches, let alone climb them," I whined. "Describe what you've got, then." "Simple." "Well, I think it's simple. It doesn't look like a leaflet. Largish, stout, kind of tough." "What's the word for kind of tough? Coriaceous? Go on, shape." "Egg-shaped. I mean, ovate, with a slight point. Hairless or glabrous, if you'd rather. On the upper side, softly felted on the under." "Felted? Tomentose." Jane was warming to her task. "You've already got a stack of identifying characteristics. You should be able to key the whole tree out just from this one leaf. Don't speculate. Investigate. What else have I taught you to look for?" "I knew that one. Oil dots." "So get the glass and look for them." Sternly, she got up to clear away the dishes. I ploughed through the Red Book until I was only one page from the end. "What about this? Leaves 8 to 18 centimetres long, ovate or broad ovate, bluntly pointed, rather thick and tough, the main veins impressed above, strongly raised and prominent below, leaf undersurfaces softly and densely hairy with fawn hairs. This must be white beech." I couldn't bear the thought of a tree so sumptuous, smothered under the heap of rampant lantana. The CCRRS workforce was supposed to be proceeding in an orderly fashion, clearing zones in sequence, but this was a case for emergency tree rescue. Nothing is more rewarding than to spy an ancient rainforest aristocrat struggling under a blanket of suffocating lantana or kangaroo vine and gently to remove its load. It can't be done quickly. To rip out canes or vines is to rip the tree. Instead, we hack our way in under the marauder, scraping and poisoning as we go, until all its connections with the ground are severed. If we drag the lantana canes out of the old white beech, hundreds of epiphytes, orchids, ferns and mosses would have come out with them. Instead, we waited for the canes to die and finally to fall. The first bearded branches to emerge from the twiggy mess of dead lantana seemed half rotten themselves. I watched them anxiously week by week until they began to push out furry new leaves of a thick pastel green, unusual in the rainforest. Before the leaves had finished coming in, the great old tree sent up a silent shout of victory and gushed torrents of blossom. China white cymes that turned violet blue as they aged. The struggle to get a sight of them involved a good deal of rock scrambling and tree climbing and subsequent tick infestation, but the sight of the tree in its glory was well worth it. Amongst the blossoms in the canopy, sulphur-crested cockatoos eyed us quizzically, never pausing as they nipped off the big dead nettle flowers at the neck and threw them to the forest floor, while around them a billion insects plundered the pollen and the nectar. After the torrent of blossom came loads of fruit, flattened spherical drupes of the same china white and violet blue as the flowers. We waited till the fruit began to rain down, turning the forest floor fluorescent lavender blue. As soon as the sun slid behind the edge of the Lamington Plateau, and only minutes ahead of the hordes of small nocturnal herbivores who would grab the fruit and hide it away for future consumption, we would gather up all we could find, mindful of Floyd's grim account of propagating white beech. Germination is very slow, such as 37% after 5 months. Percussion and shell removal is either not feasible or beneficial. Flesh should be removed and seed soaked for 2 months, then dried in the sun for 1 day, followed by further soaking before sowing. Half the fruit I gave away to a professional grower. The rest I prepared myself. Nothing about soaking for 2 months made sense to me. It sounded too much like drowning. Most growers of rainforest species soak the freshly gathered fruits overnight to drown the larvae that will otherwise hatch in almost every one and eat the seed kernel before it can germinate. After the fruit had soaked for a full 24 hours, I took on the toil of peeling off the droop to lay bare the squat round nut. Within minutes, my hands were thickly coated in an odd-smelling brownish exudate that so stuck my fingers together I could hardly wield my knife. I struggled on for hour after hour as my fingers stiffened under the relentless build-up. As the uncomfortable hours crept by, I had no way of knowing whether what I was doing was for the best or even necessary. I let the seeds dry off, but not in the sun. I tucked them into a special compost in an old broccoli box scavenged from the supermarket, wetted them through, and put over them a car window pane that I'd found lying under the old farmhouse. For 6 months, the box remained forgotten on a shelf among old wool sacks, broken furniture, and rusting machine parts. It was one of my mad ideas. No one else was interested, and anyway, it would never work. When I came back from England 6 months later, I made sure that my box was one of those placed in our makeshift propagation unit, where it would be watered automatically twice a day. A month went by. I didn't even ask about my box because I was so sure that the effort had been wasted. I was fussing over Gary's bull terrier bitch one morning when Gary stuck his head out of the door of the propagation unit and said, "Something here you should see."
Jermaine Greer has been reading from White Beech. The program was abridged and produced by Jane Marshall Productions. It continues tomorrow. Now here's Sailing By to take us to the shipping forecast. Now on BBC Radio 4, the shipping forecast issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at 0015 on Friday, the 31st of January. There are warnings of gales in all areas except Trafalgar. The general synopsis at 1800. High, western Russia, 1,057. Slow-moving, declining 1,051 by midday tomorrow. Low, mid-Atlantic, 962, expected 150 miles west of Rockall, 938 by same time. The area forecasts for the next 24 hours. Viking, north at Sarah, south at Sarah, 40s. Southeasterly, 6 to gale 8, increasing severe gale 9, perhaps storm 10 later, except in north at Sarah. Wintry showers, good, occasionally poor. Cromartie, 4th Tyne, Dogger. Southeast 4R5, increasing 7 to severe gale 9, showers, rain.